Welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selena Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pavitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship, and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Project Love podcast. It's Selena here today, and I'm the life design and career change coach of the duo. And in these episodes, when I'm flying solo, I like to talk about what it takes to create a life that you love and a career that you love. But I also really like to get into conversations that we often don't have because they're uncomfortable conversations, but that they're conversations that we really need to have. And one of those conversations I'm really, really passionate about is talking about racism, anti-racism, and white privilege. So I have invited back onto the podcast Nova Reed. Nova Reed is an anti-racism activist, a TEDx speaker. She's just done an amazing TEDx talk that we talk about in the podcast, all about microaggressions, which is the topic that we're talking about today. She is founder of New Bride. She is an incredible writer, and she runs an amazing online course called White Privilege and Anti-Racism, to help white people dismantle their own inner racism and be part of the movement to help dismantle racism in our society. Now, if you are white and you haven't listened to our previous episode on white privilege, I really recommend you go and do that. These conversations around racism can be really triggering, whether you're black, white, brown, but in particular, the way we talk about it, which is to recognize that racism is something that we all have within us because we come from a society that has systemic racism in its foundations. But that can be, if you're new to that conversation, it can be really triggering. And when you get triggered, it can stop you from listening and to get into the yes, but, which we talk about in this podcast. So if you haven't heard that one and you are new to this conversation and you're white, then I recommend you go and listen to that. It was a really powerful episode, that one. And this one is also a really powerful episode. I'm excited for you to hear it. I am also, I'm going to be honest, definitely going to get a massive vulnerability hangover once it goes out, because I am new to this conversation. And as a white woman, I still find it uncomfortable because we are talking about, and I do a lot of laughing in inappropriate moments because I'm uncomfortable, and it's kind of like a coping mechanism. So you hear me at the start of the episode, and I do want to say this, as I first start talking about microaggressions, I sort of laugh as I say things like, you know, examples like, can I touch your hair? And, oh, look, you know, I'm almost dark as you know for after I come back from holiday. And you'll hear me sort of kind of laugh and make light of those. They're not light. And I don't take those, certainly don't take microaggressions lightly. This is what's so good about this conversation. It's really raw. It's a black woman and a white woman sitting together and talking about daily racism and microaggressions. If you've not heard about microaggressions, don't know what they are, then this is what we're going to be talking about in this episode. And you also get to hear me have my own moment where I feel so uncomfortable with what we're talking about that I try to minimize it. And I have my own yes, but moment. So, but I catch myself. I say that I sort of think in the moment that it's a microaggression. Actually, in retrospect, it's not so much a microaggression as it is a minimizing the story that is being told in that moment. Anyway, we work through it live in the recording. Nova said to me, you know, we can cut that bit out. I was like, no way, this is the whole point. This is an example of how we need to be having these conversations, not being afraid to stumble, catch ourselves, particularly as a white person in the conversation. And the importance as a white person to just listen. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this episode. I'm uncomfortable about putting it out there. And I will say, since doing our first recording, our first episode, when Nova and I met in person for the first time, since then, a really beautiful relationship between us has evolved. So in this one, it's two friends now actually talking about racism and, you know, how to build that trust up between a black woman and a white woman, and to how to build up that trust between a black woman and a white woman, because, you know, a lot of trust has been lost over the centuries, and it's up to white women and white people to rebuild that trust. I can't recommend Nova's course more. I really can't. I feel, particularly as a parent, it is incredibly, incredibly important work for me to do. The course has been life-changing. I really mean that. So if you want to find out more, go to Nova Reid, NovaReid.com. You'll find out all about her there. But for now, I don't know if I say sit back and relax and listen. I just say open your minds, open your hearts, particularly those of you who are white, who are new to this conversation. Leave, if you notice shame bubbling up, leave it at the door. Just sit and listen with no judgment. And if you are black or brown, thank you for your patience in me as a white person. I'm just at the beginning of this journey and I will continue to stumble and hopefully as much as possible catch myself. But I am, this will be lifelong work, and I am really and truly committed to it and committed to continuing to have these conversations on and offline. So let's get on with this conversation.
Hi, Nova.
Hi, Selena.
We're back.
We're back.
For the second instalment on anti-racism. The first episode that we did together was so, so powerful. I think we both found it really powerful.
Yeah.
And so many people wrote to say how powerful it was. So thank you for that one.
Pleasure.
But we're back for more, because what we didn't get to talk about in that episode was microaggressions. And you have just recently done a TED talk on microaggressions.
I have indeed.
Congratulations. What was it called, so people could go and have a look at it?
It is called Not All Superheroes Wear Capes, How You Have the Power to Change the World.
Amazing.
And I deliberately didn't call it microaggressions because no one's going to Google search that, are they?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I would like to say that that TED talk brought me to, like, made me well up at the end.
Aww.
I wasn't expecting it. I was like, I've heard all this stuff before from Nova. I've done your course. I've done the stuff on microaggressions, but it beautiful. It was beautiful and really moving and powerful.
Thank you.
So I definitely recommend you all go and listen to that. Watch it, rather. So in the last episode, it was really for predominantly for our white listeners to talk about white privilege and racism and anti-racism and what we can do as white people to help dismantle racism by turning the light on our own inner racism, the journey that I've been on with you for over a year now, mm-hmm. really. And wow, what a transformative journey. I highly recommend Nova's course. What is it called again?
I just it's got a terrible
name. I feel
name.
Like the name changes. Is it white privilege?
It's white privilege or anti-racism, depending on what my mood is. But you can find it via my website.
It is an incredible course and it has been life-changing. And it really has very powerful, deep work. I think perhaps just having a black woman talking about her experience of racism in such an open way, and then, yeah, and inviting us to shine a light on our own inner racism in a space of no shame. Mm. Like, we've all got it because of the system that we're in, and let's do something about it. And it's just incredible.
I mean, it's really moving to hear you say that, because obviously when I created the course, it's the first time I'd ever put the content together. I don't know if it's going to work or not.
Yeah.
And so to hear your journey, hear the feedback, see the messages that I get in my inbox from other people who are you know, not quite as far along on the journey as you are, and just to hear how it's already impacting their lives is incredible, because it also brings hope that actually, you know, with a bit of courage and consistency, we are on the cusp of change if just people wake up.
Mm. Yeah. And I think for me, I realized that it's about finally breaking that pattern in my family line of racism.
Yeah.
You know, and so the impact then on my son going forward and the person he will be into the world, I hope.
It's
an incredible course. So whereas the last episode was predominantly for white listeners to open up this conversation about racism and what we can do about racism, this one about microaggressions, we want to make it for all our listeners. So for the white listeners, it's about perhaps you don't know what microaggressions are. So let's talk about that and what they are and understanding that. And then for the black and brown listeners, you're going to talk about what kind of guidance you offer, how you navigate those moments where someone says, "So where are you from? Can I touch your hair?" And all the other things that I probably have most definitely said at some point in my life.
I get a physiological response to just hearing those, and we're just, you know, we're doing this in jest. But what I will say is that there are a lot of black and brown friends and peers who don't know what microaggressions are. We will feel them. We know that they are happening to us, but we don't all have the language because it's still a relatively new term for us in the mainstream. It's was first coined in 1970 by a psychiatrist and academic called Chester Pierce, but it's still relatively unknown in the mainstream. So I will just give the definition, the black and white definition, no pun intended. They are everyday verbal, non-verbal and environmental slights, snubs or insults, whether intentional or unintentional, which communicate hostile, derogatory or negative messages to the target person's based solely upon their marginalized group membership. And I think that is quite difficult to process.
Yeah.
So the way that I describe them is they are everyday comments or behaviors that make you feel like you're misplaced, that make you feel like you're an other. And that can be anything from you minding your business and somebody feeling that they have a sense of entitlement to put their hands in your hair, through being continuously spoken over. So women will potentially have experienced this in male-dominated environments. Being undermined, being mistaken as a cleaner or a service staff when you're in a senior manager's meeting on a consistent basis. Just something that other people project a racial bias or a racial stereotype that you don't somehow belong here. So why are you here? Where are you from? Now, where are you really from?
And also a sort of underlying sense of superiority.
Yes.
And that you are inferior.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think other great examples have been when a white person steps into a lift with a black man or a young black man, and the woman might just very subtly, might not even be aware she's doing it, pulls her handbag closer to herself, or her body language changes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, walking into a shop and there's a couple of black kids there, and maybe your body language can subtly.
Yeah, you suddenly
and I started
feel fear.
Noticing, yeah, and I started noticing tiny little things like that. Was my body language opening or was it subtly closing?
Lovely.
And to think that people don't perceive that, they do perceive that. It was in those subtleties. And I talked to you about this, about in the school playground and my son starting school. And I noticed my instinctive sense was to go towards white women like me.
Yes.
And so I deliberately went towards other people, be it a man or a black woman, and deliberately did that. And suddenly was just like, this is what it's about. It's opening up and connecting and not staying in your
narrow
familiar
bubble.
Yeah, your familiar stream, and then realizing the impact that will have on my son, subtly sensing or what it would have been of subtly sensing that I'm always going towards people like me.
That one is better, that one is safer.
Yes, this is people like me, people that look like me, always going to that. And also, I know you've shared things about your husband, who's a black man, and him being mindful of...
Oh, he's hypersensitive to being a black man. He will, if he's walking around just the road innocently and it's dark and there's a woman walking towards him, he will automatically cross the road. Mm. I remember we went to New Forest last year. So there's always a sense of, I don't know how we're going to be perceived when we move further out into the countryside to certain pockets of the UK. But it's a, you know, it's a well-known place that people like to visit. It's a tourist attraction. So you would like to think that, you know, it's a safe and open space. And we got lost. We were trying to find, we were going somewhere and we got lost. And I was faffing around with my sat-nav. And I saw, I think they were a couple. So they were probably in their 50s. And they were white. And I said, oh, go and ask them directions, will you? And he just sat in the car. And I was bumbling around with the sat-nav. I said, oh, didn't you hear me? Can you ask them?
What are you still doing?
Just get on with it. And he's like, no. And then I pushed. And he said, I don't want to have to get out of the car. They're going to see a black man in the middle of this. We were literally in a forest. I don't want to have to deal with them. I don't want to deal with the microaggressions of them being intimidated by me. So can you get out? And in that moment, I got out and asked him for directions. He, I'm sure he won't mind me sharing. So we moved. So I grew up in Hertfordshire. So 25-minute drive from London. I was in and out of London a lot. So very diverse. He grew up in Southeast London. So, you know, we see ourselves represented in those areas. And we decided to move further out to the countryside. And he was job hunting, decided he didn't want to do the commute back to London every day anymore. He was shortlisted for a job interview. And he got on site to the manager who would be interviewing him. And he said the guy took two steps back when David came in, when my husband came in. He took two steps back from him. And he said, I know he didn't expect me to be a black man. And he said, the reason why I know he didn't expect me to be a black man was because he didn't ask me one single competency question in that. He didn't interview him properly. He'd already decided that he's not a right fit for the company. He didn't ask him one single competency question. And he's not had that for quite some time. So, you know, we're having these conversations now where he's talking about how he is perceived and the microaggressions he receives as a black man are very different to the ones I receive as a woman. Like, he is racially profiled around the shops quite often. Mm. He'll go in, you know, we all have our bags for life in your local supermarket. And I'd gone off to pick up some meat and he was shopping in Morrison's and I came back to find him standing outside the car and he just didn't look right. And I said, are you okay? So I think I've just been racially profiled. They saw him with his bags for life and assumed that he was shoplifting. That was a few months ago.
Yeah. So this stuff is daily.
Daily. These are microaggressions.
Yeah. And what is the impact?
The impact in the day-to-day, I mean, I will speak from my experience,
yeah.
is that there is this low-level anxiety that you are anticipating some form of attack, some form of othering. And one of the ways I will avoid this is I will shop online. I will use a self-checkout. And I'm a very sociable person, but sometimes if I'm feeling a bit more vulnerable for whatever reason... I don't want to put myself in an environment where I'm going to receive that. And I guess I'm more hypersensitive because of the socio-political climate we're in and the fact that race hate, religious hate crime, disability hate crime, homophobic hate crime is all increasing right now. I work for myself, so I don't always have to be out and about. So when I am out and about, I'm more hypersensitive to it. But there is research from neuroscientists, social psychologists and psychiatrists that have done study after study that show people, well, they've done these studies on black people who are exposed to regular racial stress, such as microaggressions, the brain pattern is revealing the same trauma on the brain as soldiers who have served in war.
I mean, I've heard that from that stat from you before. Yeah. Each time it really drives it home.
So PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. So when you get white people saying it's oversensitivity, yeah, it's just a total lack of awareness and understanding of what's actually the lived experience.
Yeah. And what makes them so dangerous is exactly that. It's the frequency with which that you're experiencing. You can experience these several times a day, every day.
And you don't know when it's going to happen.
You don't know when it's going to happen. It catches you off guard. And it's why you often hear from people within the black or brown community that they would prefer, if they had to choose, rather not deal with any of them, to be fair, but if you had to choose, they would prefer a one-off or a rare confrontation with somebody in a far-right extreme yeah. movement than deal with this every damn day.
Yeah.
Because one, I know you. I can sense danger when I see you because you've got tattoos and swastikas all over your body. That's a sign that you are not for me, so I can protect myself from you theoretically, or you can expect that the kind of reaction you're going to get. But from everyday well-meaning people, you know, friends, partners, doctors, family, co-workers, journalists, yeah. doctors, healthcare professionals, midwives, it catches you off guard, and it's the frequency that builds up, which is what causes the most harm.
Mm.
And also because we're unsophisticated at recognising them in ourselves and each other, and therefore they just go unaddressed. Yeah.
Well, like you said, you know, there will be black and brown people who haven't heard of microaggressions, and perhaps I might have been you, but it was definitely speaking to a black woman who, when she looked back, when she had been at work, she was like, now I understand, I think it probably was you, now I understand what was going on was microaggressions.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
at the time, you didn't have the vocabulary for it.
Yeah.
And so at the time, when you've had that in work situations, which you now see, that was what was going on. At the time, did you think you were going crazy? Did you think you were being,
well, yeah.
you couldn't understand where the anxiety was coming from?
I mean, it felt irrational. That would be the, right. I'd be like, what? There's nothing significant. I would always be like, why do I feel like this? There is nothing significant that has happened. So I would then turn it on myself. Like,
yes.
it's me, there's something wrong with me. And then, of course, when you're continuously gaslit, or your lived experience is, you're being told it's all in your head, or you're being oversensitive, or you just can't quite put your finger on why you feel that way, then you do start to question your own sanity.
And that's exactly what people say when they're in psychologically abusive relationships.
Oh, yeah.
And then afterwards they realize that person was mentally unwell, and I was, you know, yeah. it was psychological abuse, but at the time you think you're going crazy.
Yeah.
And I've experienced that. Or you've got a boss who very subtly, you Ooh, can't put your finger, yes. undermines
oh,
you.
Oh gosh, yeah.
You know, because I say to people sometimes who've had a boss who's done that, just, and I say, you know, that slow chipping away of your confidence,
mm.
but that's what microaggressions are. And mm. they start from the age of, From the moment you're born, if you're black or brown skinned. And so when you put it in, when I think about when I see people in the context of work, how a year or 6 months for the boss that's been undermining them, and
oh,
their
yeah.
confidence has been crushed.
Yeah.
And then you think, okay, well, then you take that and put it lifelong.
Yeah.
That's what we're actually, that's what we're dealing with.
And that's why my work centres around talking to people who are liberal, well-meaning, kind-hearted, and who are responsible for doing microaggressions on a regular basis, because it's the most damaging and dangerous thing, because it's continuous. And I had someone, I did a post on microaggressions, and I had a follower reach out to me on Instagram who was born in a black majority country, I can't remember where, and she now lives and works in the UK mm. As a medical practitioner. And she said, I had a great childhood, early adulthood, very confident in my work. And she said, I've come here and I am, my confidence is on the floor. Imagine that, you're getting
wow.
this incredible talent and their confidence is on the floor because they're now having to live with and experience these microaggressions. And, you know, I don't doubt that Duke and Duchess of Sussex, particularly Meghan, was the recipient of this on an ongoing basis. And she's like,
no,
there's no way in hell I'm tolerating this.
You know what I love about that? I love what they've done. But we're not here to talk about that.
Sorry.
But I think that, but I do love what they've done on so many levels. But Prince Harry has, he's protecting, he's making as much as he can a yes. safe space for his family to thrive in.
100%.
And that's why he's made that change. And I've really been thinking about this a lot and in light of what you do and the importance, you know, we talk about inclusion, inclusivity. Do we say inclusivity? Have I made a word
up? No, we do.
And diversity, but in real basic terms, the way I see that is to say we need to make our schools and our hospitals and our communities and our places of work safe spaces for people.
Yes.
People with black and brown skin, disabled people, people, you know, trans, gay, queer. We need to make these places safe spaces. So I think sometimes when I put it in that terminology, it's to say, do you want your place of work to be a safe space yes. for black or brown people to work in? Of course I do. Okay, if you're speaking to white people, this is what you need to learn. This is what you need to do in order to make it a safe space.
Yes.
So when we're talking about microaggressions specifically, and someone, they run a company, they're white, they're predominantly white team,
yes,
and they want to diversify, how can they make that space safe so that when they get their black and brown employees coming in, they can feel that, yeah, this is a place where I'm not going to suddenly get microaggressions, they come with a smile, they're well-meaning, no one thinks they're doing any harm, they think they're being friendly, they think perhaps they're trying to connect by saying, so where are you from? Oh, lovely hair, can I touch it? You know, we laugh about it, but I know that it's not a laughing matter because there's even a book called Don't Touch My Hair. Like it's, can you, those two questions, talk to me about that. How, what happens for you when I say to you, imagine I'm saying, I love your hair. Oh, can I touch it? Or actually, I know I've got a friend who, she's had people come up to her.
Yeah.
And not ask.
And just put their hands
touch
on her
it,
hair.
And then said to her daughter, oh, come and feel her hair. Isn't
you know
it lovely?
What? This is what troubles me deeply about this, because, again, people are not thinking or have no awareness of the historical context of that, the historical context of fetishizing black women, the historical context of our bodies not being our own, and the historical context of that there used to be human zoos where black children were paraded around like a zoo with animals that you can imagine now for white people to look at and prod and poke like there was some kind of animal. So my body, so to me, it comes down to basic consent. My body is for no one else to touch other than who I give consent to. So to me, I'm like, why do you have such a sense of entitlement that it's okay to put hands on someone else's body that is not yours?
Because you wouldn't do that to another
else.
White person.
Yeah.
This is the thing. Like that woman who did it to a mixed race woman or black or brown woman, that she'd happily do it. I guarantee if someone turned around and did it to her hair, ooh, look how glossy your hair, or just like, just start touching her hair and then say to their child, come and touch this woman's hair.
You would feel strange. I mean, the first time it happens, you might, oh, that's a bit strange. But if you get that consistently over an elongated period of time, not going to feel okay anymore. Mm. Remember the first significant time that happened to me, I was just 18 and I'd started professional dance training and we're still friends now. His name is Peter. I adore him. And he, I think, grew up in Hartlepool, I think, somewhere very white. And he said he'd never seen a black person before. And I just found it quite remarkable. But bearing in mind, there were only 4 black people on my entire course, and I was one of them. So we were also a novelty in that environment. And he said, I had braids at the time. He said, can I touch your hair? And at that point, I was like, okay, it's weird, but if you really must, go on then. I gave him permission. And then he was just playing around with it, and then he asked me what it was like to be black, and I said, what's it like to be white? And then he said that was a defining learning moment for him. From that moment on, he realized how ridiculous, how insensitive, and how invasive he was being, And he's one of my best allies now.
Wow. Well, there you go, though.
Yeah. But at that time, I felt like, all right, you okay, knock yourself out. On another day, I'd be like, no, you can't. But all he needed was that tiny interaction with me, and he said it just changed him. Yeah.
So that brings us to the sort of almost more complex and tricky topic, I think, of when work. You get those microaggressions at work from colleagues who you have a relationship with and who you see day in, day out, and are perhaps even becoming friends with. Mm. And also new mate, well, perhaps it can also, has it come from people you've been friends with for a long time, or does it usually happen early days?
Early days.
Right.
Often with people who are acquaintances or colleagues, sometimes strangers. I've been in art galleries before and asked, where am I from, by three different people within 10 minutes. Mm. So I think I'll go back to your question about how workplaces can be safe spaces, because what I want to, I guess, articulate is that a safe space doesn't mean you're going to be free from microaggressions. Mm. But what it does mean is that when a microaggression happens, you can call it out without being gaslit and minimized, and have that person seek to change their behavior so it doesn't continue, so that the outcome changes. And I think that's the ideal, that there are spaces that are, when we say safe spaces, it's not being free from these things ever happening to you again. Yeah. Definitely reduce, working to reduce them happening, but that when they do, because they're highly likely to, there is a support system in place where things change.
Yeah.
Where you can call it out without being called that you're an angry aggressive, without being demonized, without receiving further abuse for speaking up on trauma, and where that doesn't happen again.
Mm. So there needs to be an awareness in that culture of that company.
Yes.
And an open conversation and a willingness for people to
receive feedback.
Yeah.
Without shutting down and kicking off. So a lot of it is about giving people feedback. So there's two sides to this. The work needs to come from the majority group. So let's stick with race, the white majority group. If they are doing the work, then just like you will have more awareness of what a microaggression is. So you will already be being mindful not to do them. It gets difficult if it falls on us that every single time it happens, us as in black people or people of colour, if it falls on us to educate every single time it happens.
Yeah.
Because not only am I experiencing a physiological change in my body that could potentially trigger anxiety, or the worst end of that spectrum, contribute to PTSD, I'm then having to educate you, I'm then having to risk giving you feedback only to be shut down by you. So
it's a lot of emotional labor.
So my answer to that is that we shouldn't have to do it, but I also think we should be able to say, I'm not answering that question. You don't mind? I'm going to answer that question when next time someone asks me where I'm from, and without having to give an explanation as to why.
Mm.
And that, I guess, takes building confidence, because we have also learned and been taught that whenever we speak up about racism, oh, it wasn't racism, it was a clash of personalities, or it was a joke, or it was misunderstood. So racism is always explained away. So then you just shut your mouth and say nothing, and then it starts becoming suppressed. So for us, it's about having to find ways to be able to speak our truth without fear of retribution, in a way that, we feel safe as well. And sometimes that safety comes from the environment that we're in. And if we don't feel safe, then we'll probably internalize it.
I would imagine also, this has come up in conversations actually, about how when something happens and a microaggression happens, and the person who's received it, the black or brown person, has kind of been startled, shocked, and just freezes, doesn't say anything.
Yes.
Then the moment passes.
Yes.
I think that is probably how I would most likely respond, rather than that moment going, hang on a second, I'd probably go. And then afterwards, being able to bring that up.
Yes.
How would you recommend... What's a good way of approaching that, I guess, with someone that you know, maybe the friendly colleague at work, and they've said something about, oh, here's another one, remember, the comparing, I come back from holiday, and I got a little brown, like, little tan, like, oh, almost as brown as you, Nova, and hold my skin to your skin.
Oh, I had that so much.
Right, so that happens from your really lovely colleague who you love, you know it's coming from a good place, but you want to let her or him know afterwards on reflection, like, please don't do that. What? Okay, I'm going to ask another question. If you didn't say something to that person, friendly Jill, let's call her, would you then feel there was a bit of, does it create a distance?
It can do. It breaks down trust.
Right.
Means I don't trust you. But again, this isn't always conscious.
This isn't
always conscious. So it can definitely, you know, every moment we have with a person is an opportunity to either build trust or lose trust. So when those things happen, we're breaking trust. Mm. And most of the time this isn't conscious. So microaggressions themselves generally are, I mean, they're not all. Some of them are conscious. A lot of them are happening because of a subconscious prejudice that you have that you're not addressing. It's suppressed prejudice coming out as a microaggression.
Exactly.
That's basically what is happening. So you will have inner racism, racial bias, racial stereotyping, assumptions, whatever they might be, perceptions about people, and that prejudice will come out in your behaviour or in the words that you choose to use, or, you know, oh, I'm almost as dark as you now. Bizarre attempt to connect. Anyway, if it happens, they're hard to tackle in the moment. I struggle as well. And generally, I struggle is when I don't feel safe, which is most of the time, because most environments aren't set up to be able to address them, right? But one way is, if it's happening with an individual and it's happened more than once, it's jotting down each incident and then saying, either, you know, having a text message or having a chat saying, can we have I'd really love to talk to you about something that's been happening over the past week or couple of weeks. And then sit down with them and say, and then bring each experience up, or the one experience, and say, do you remember when you did this? And then repeat what they did or said.
Mm.
One example is, why did you do that?
Oh, that's brilliant.
So it turns it back around on them, and it gets them to a place where they need to start getting curious with their own behaviour.
Yeah, because then it hands it over to them. Like you say, the emotional labour should not be on the person on the receiving end of the microaggressions.
It really shouldn't, but I also recognise that sometimes it is.
Yeah.
So that would be my first one. And if you feel safe to, or, you know, you have the current capacity to engage in this, another way is, you remember what you did then? What you did was offensive, or what you did can be offensive, or what you did hurt me, or what you did made me feel like X.
Yeah.
And then you give the why.
Yeah.
But that, I don't think, is our responsibility. I would only say, I would only encourage anyone to do that if they really are invested in that relationship.
I was going to say,
yeah,
because
risking yourself.
You're going really deep.
Yeah, you're going deep, and you're also risking that they're going to come back and gaslight you. So I would only advocate that you do that if that's a relationship that you feel is worth investing in, and you have the capacity in mind, body, and spirit to run the risk of receiving further abuse.
Mm. And when, as a white person, receiving feedback, you've said before a couple of brilliant lines, like, what would be, actually, I'll ask you this, what would be the dream response from a white person? So say I've done that to you. I've gone, oh, Nova, look, I'm almost as dark as you now. And then you come to me and you say, you know, when you did that,
mm-hmm.
it made me feel
mm-hmm.
really uncomfortable, or whatever you, what it, or why did you do that? Or you just, you know, let me know how it felt.
Yeah.
What would be the ideal response from me as a white person?
It's so simple. I'm really sorry. It's so simple. Just apologize, even if you didn't mean it, even if you don't understand why we might be appearing, I'm doing imaginary quotes, appearing to be getting bent out of shape about nothing. Just saying, I'm really sorry, because regardless of your intent, you've caused harm. You've hurt somebody that you care about, or someone that you have a relationship with. I'm really sorry. Or, you know, expanding on that, you know, this isn't my experience of the world. Can you tell me more so I can better understand so that I don't do that again in the future, yeah. or I can try my best not to do that again?
Yeah. And like, and while we're at it, is there anything else?
Yeah.
And,
is there anything else?
Is there anything else that,
I've said or could potentially say?
In the past.
Along those lines. Because now, but you know what's so interesting? I found so powerful about learning about microaggressions is that I feel before there was a sense of lack of connection that I felt, maybe a fear of saying the wrong thing, because I wasn't sure what the wrong thing was. And once you learn about microaggressions and the othering of people and where that's coming from, so what seems like, but what's wrong? I'm saying you've got lovely hair and I want to touch it. What's wrong with that? When you start to get curious and identify where that could be coming from, and as you always say, everything without shame, like this is just where we're at. Where is that coming from? Then it's just like, okay, it's not so, it's got stuff behind it. It's not just a nice compliment that I'm giving you.
I think it's just acknowledging that we as individual human beings can't possibly know everything about everything at one go. So it's acknowledging that, okay, in my head, this seems really, really irrational. I don't know why they're getting so upset about something so small, but just trust in their experience that this has got to have, for it to cause harm, it's got to have substance. Even if you don't know where that substance is coming from, to me, it's lack of trust. If I'm telling you that you've hurt me, why don't you believe me? Why do you minimize it by saying, oh, it was just a joke? It doesn't matter what your intentions were. You've caused harm. So let's, you know, like Brené Brown would say, let's be adults and take responsibility for that harm and move on.
Yeah. And you could, I'm just thinking of things I've heard people say, oh, well, but my other friend who's black and she doesn't mind people touching her hair. It's
irrelevant.
So
we're not like, I've just given you an example. When my friend Peter first asked to touch my hair, I was like, okay, fair, whatever. I was in a mood where I was open.
Yeah.
Probably because we were all new students. I felt comfortable. There was an element of safety there. All of, you know, my black peers were around. I think he went through at least two of our hair touching them. So it was less about me. And I felt like I wanted to in that moment. And that's my right to give consent to who I want to whenever I want, or to not give consent. But the point is, we're not a monolith. Like we don't expect every single white person to behave
feel
and think
the
and feel
same.
The same. So why is it? Well, it's again, this bizarre, they're racial stereotypes. People are stereotyping us to all be the same, to all think the same. To not be individuals.
Just then you were talking about the fact that if this is something that upsets someone or or offends someone, that's enough, rather than trying to, yes, but all those arguments, but I didn't mean it. But I didn't mean it in that way. It doesn't matter. Like if it offends someone, if it upsets them, that's enough to not do it. And it's like, for example, we used to use, we used to say the Project Love Tribe.
Yes.
And then it came to my attention that the use of the word tribe is considered cultural appropriation.
Yes.
And people find it who are from
indigenous
tribes find it offensive when the modern world and hipsters and liberals use the word tribe and, you know, to sort of talk about their community online. And I was talking about this with a group of people and they were sort of saying whether to use this word tribe. And then there was this debate about, well, but some people find it offensive. And then someone's like, yeah, but aren't people all just oversensitive these days? That classic line. And that's where I said, but the point is, if there are people who, even if we don't understand it, that doesn't mean it's not offensive.
No.
It just means we don't understand it.
No.
If people are saying they find it offensive, then they're finding it. It's so weird, isn't it? Yeah, but I didn't mean it like that. Yeah, but I didn't mean it to be offensive. That doesn't matter. That's not what we're debating. We're not debating if you're a good person or not. I think that's important, because that's where it boils down to, isn't it? So much of the time. But no, but I'm a nice one, but I'm not racist. Well, let's open that can of worms. Because they're not saying you're not nice, yeah, but you can be nice and racist and also not be aware that you're, yes, being racist. Yes. And that is what it's all about.
That's what it's about. It's rejecting, right? One, adults are not great at receiving feedback that is interpreted as negative anyway. They're not great at being told they've done something wrong. We're not great at that, especially British people.
Oh God, I don't like being told I've done something. I feel ashamed. I feel like I want to. No, I will do everything to make you wrong, not me. But that's what it is, isn't it?
So for some people, so I am somebody, if I have done something to cause another person harm, I am mortified. How that sometimes manifests in me personally is that I will go introverted and start beating myself up for not doing better. For some people, they feel it as a personal attack on who they are as an individual. And when you feel like you're under attack, the quickest form of defense is to go on the attack.
Yep.
So then they shut down. They're not listening. There's no change in behavior. There's no opportunity for growth because you're just being oversensitive. It's a bloody joke. You're the one with the problem, not me. So it moves that shame, that embarrassment, that guilt, that vulnerability off of them and goes back to the other person.
Yeah. And so I recognize myself in that, in my relationship, in arguments.
Yes, sure.
So I definitely respond like to that. And I certainly did in the early days of the work with you, shining a light on my inner racism. I mean, even being able to say that now just rolls off the tongue.
So freeing, isn't it?
There was something that in the course that you said that was really powerful around microaggressions. And it was that the reason we have these microaggressions and then you can say what you actually said, and I'll sort of roughly paraphrase, is because we've stuffed down, the racism is now hidden. Whereas, yes, before it was overt, it's, yes, easier to deal with. But because we've stuffed it down, we're not allowed to be like that anymore. So we'll just pretend, we'll just brush it under the carpet, yeah, all that mess, yeah, all that dog
poo. We just pretend it's not there.
Smudge it down and pretend it's not there.
We've got the equality
so what
now
is and coming up is these horrible whiffs of poo.
But it spreads and it spreads and it spreads.
But that's what it is, yes, isn't it? It's ultimately coming from the fact that we haven't dealt with the racism.
No.
We haven't healed it. We haven't owned it.
We haven't
gone through a whole process of grieving and apologising and all the rest of it and hearing the impact of it and being sitting with that. And instead we've stuffed it and said that's why it's coming up in these microaggressions. Yeah. Some seem totally like well-meaning, like can, yes, I touch your lovely hair, and others not so much, yeah, where I'm pulling my handbag back, yeah, because 17-year-old kid who happens to be black is in a lift with me and I've suddenly decided to
that he's a criminal,
that he's a threat to me.
Yeah.
I
think, you know, in the 4 years of the Holocaust, Germany have done more in the past 60 years to atone. That includes paying reparations to the people or the surviving families of the Holocaust and to acknowledge what they did over the past 60 years. And I'm not saying Germany is perfect because they're not. But that is an acknowledgement, countrywide acknowledgement and doing something to atone. In the 400 plus years, it's recorded because there's stuff that's not recorded that we have on record of mass genocide, of slavery, of Britain's very, very deep and problematic role in colonization, we have done nothing to atone. We have done nothing to pay reparations. We have done nothing to acknowledge. Most people don't know their history. We've got delightful actors like Lawrence Fox getting bent out of shape when there is a Sikh soldier in Sam Mendes' new film 1917 saying this is just another diversity agenda, and pushing diversity onto a white majority audience is institutionally racist. He had to be schooled publicly. Actually, there were 1.5 million Indian soldiers who served alongside British soldiers. They came over because they were one of British colonies to serve voluntarily alongside British soldiers to help Britain win the war. One in six of those soldiers were Indian, one in five were Sikh, plus the West Indies Regiment, which was over about 16,000. So we have this perception that the only people serving in the war and fighting in the war were white men. Why do we have that perception?
Mm-hmm.
Because every Remembrance Day, who are the faces you see when you got the little poppy and the pictures of people on social media? Who are the faces that we see? Where do we see the black? Do we see the black and brown faces every Remembrance Day? Do we talk about the fact that those soldiers who voluntarily came away from their countries to serve in the war, to get citizenship in Britain, who died for Britain, were even treated as second-class citizens in the army, were not given medals, were given less rights, were paid less. There is so much we do not know about where we come from. Mm. And until we have the desire to learn, we'll just keep piecing patterns of behaviour. And until it's atoned publicly, there's a, you know, even something small, like there is a Holocaust Memorial Day that happens every year. What do we have for slavery?
Mm. I did tell you though about the, though. Sorry, there we go. Oh, pull myself up. One small thing in Lewisham, in the shopping centre with the Windrush exhibition.
Yes.
Where they had, I did a microaggression there, didn't I? By saying though, or is it all right?
Potentially. I mean, it's all right because we have that relationship, but I think it can be interpreted that you're feeling defensive about what I've just said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
So I'll let you decide if you were to keep I'm that feeling, or not.
No, but no, absolutely. I think we should because that is exactly, so now I'm suddenly, I caught myself.
Yes, you did.
Because I caught myself and now I'm feeling really hot. Alarmed, because I feel like what I did there was that, yes, but I did. Yeah. I yes butted you. Yeah. So I heard what you said and then I felt like,
how did you feel?
Distressed by it.
Yeah.
And then quickly wanted to find some small way
to feel better,
in which it's not all bad.
Yeah.
And that's actually not the point in this conversation right now. Mm. So I'm sorry.
And I think it's okay. I think that this is it. This is the learning. And it was okay with us because we have a relationship. Mm. And the fact that you caught yourself before I even had to say anything made it not be a thing. But a really useful learning opportunity, and also really useful that, you know, this, even though you've done my course, this work is never done. We have to continuously be self-aware to catch ourselves outside of these habits, because what we're trying to do is self-soothe our ego and make ourselves feel better.
Yeah.
Because James Baldwin has this wonderful quote, and it's something like, I imagine if people let go of their anger, they would be forced to deal with pain. Mm. And I think it's similar in that we keep calm, we carry on, we brush it under and blah, 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 blah. But underneath all of that is shame and pain that's not been, that doesn't have a vehicle.
Mm. And I think if we were the enormity of what has happened, yeah, to open up and sit with that and the pain that is not, has been inflicted, but continues to be inflicted on a day-to-day basis. And to have to open up to the fact that you're a part of it. See, my work always before was working with the sense of being the oppressed as a woman.
Yes.
Quite comfortable being in that place, yeah, because it's sort of heroic. And, you know, you're the downtrodden. Yeah. I will rise up. Victimhood. I will show you.
Yeah.
So to then turn around and do the work on being the oppressor and part of that, and you can say it's unconscious and unwittingly and all the rest of it, if you want to soothe yourself a little as you do the work. But the fact is that's what this work is.
Yes.
And it's a lot easier being the oppressed woman than having to go, not only am I a white person,
yeah,
but I've done this stuff, yeah, like right there in that conversation. So I think I'll definitely keep that in, because this is the whole point.
Yeah.
This is, and like you say, I've done that course. This is the beginning of the work. You know, till the day I die, I will have to be catching myself, because systemic racism is,
it's learned behavior, and it is so, some of it is so subtle that we don't notice sometimes. And a huge part of this work is being massively self-aware, hugely self-aware, so that you can catch yourself in these patterns or these habits or feelings before they turn into cycles.
Yeah. And I think I remember saying to you this actually, because just then when that happened, I felt it energetically.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started to tune into it energetically, I was able to then sense when I was, my body, my body language was closing up and being defensive because I was walking past two young, big, tall, young black guys. Yeah. And I thought, hold on, open up your body language. Mm. See? It's
then
exactly
you're
the same.
Aware. Yeah.
Just more, and then, you know, but I think, yeah, it's, this is the, this work will be there. I will always have to be doing that and mm-hmm. catching it. And
that's okay.
Yeah. But that's the safe
because
space.
It changes the outcome. And yeah. I think that's the point. It changes the outcome. And it's when the outcome changes that things shift, that we move forward, that we progress. If we keep saying it wasn't my intention and it wasn't my fault, but the outcome remains the same, nothing changes.
Mm. Yeah. We have
ultimately want to change the outcome.
Yeah. And we and therefore we have to be willing to get on the playing field.
You have to
come, conversations
come where we are
and make and mess up. You know, it's better that you kind of go, oh, look, I'm almost the same. Oh, sorry. No, hang on a minute. I apologize.
Yeah, really sorry.
I've just caught myself there.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Or even afterwards, if you do it, or if you did it recently, if you hear one of these things, the hair or the skin color, or, you know, and you're like, oh my God, I said that to my friend at work literally a week ago. Don't fall into the pit of shame and guilt. Maybe go and have a conversation and say, you know, when I said that last week.
It was really insensitive. I'm really
sorry about that.
Yeah.
And who knows what their response might be.
Yeah. They might be, oh, you know what? I didn't even, you know, it's fine, whatever.
But they might also turn around and go, thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I get that a lot. I really appreciate it. Yeah. It just, you know, that's how, that is the only way that we are going to dismantle it and heal it, by acknowledging it as it's happening
in the moment.
Right here.
Right now.
Right now.
I had it with a friend. I just share this story. When I shared my TEDx talk a few weeks ago when it first came out, and I put it online, and one of my school friends said, oh, I've watched it and it was really eye-opening and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I see, she works in HR and she said, I see this happening all the time in the workplace and it's really difficult to address. And at the end, we were having a text message conversation. At the end of it, she said, and you know what? When you were talking about being that, I won't give it away because I want you to watch, but when you were talking about being the little girl and that incident happened to you, it could be that just the mother was really embarrassed and that she didn't want to have to get into anything with your mum. And so she was trying to explain away, make it feel better. And I went back to her and I said, I love how you're trying to change my memory for me. And I said, one, she wouldn't have been trying to avoid having a confrontation with my mum because I was on my own. And two, whether or not, whether regardless of her intention or what she was trying to do in that moment, the impact was the same. And then she, and I remember feeling slighted by it. And then she came back and she said, I'm really sorry. And it just dissipated.
Yeah.
But I know, you know, she's my friend. I know why she's doing it. She's trying. Again, it just feels so desperately sad and horrible that that could happen to somebody so young.
Yeah.
And she's also a new mum herself and would be mortified if, you know, that happened with her child. And she was trying to explain it away.
Yeah.
But in her trying to explain it away, she was invalidating my experience and minimising it. And
yeah.
And she came back, I explained, she came back and apologised. That's it, done.
And that's why the listening is so important. Just keep listening to the lived experience today and in the past.
Yes.
Of black and brown people, people with disabilities, people from the LGBTQ plus community, and, you know, anyone else who faces daily discrimination.
Daily othering.
Daily othering.
Yeah.
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 And just just keep listening. Keep listening to it. And that is also how we will learn.
Very simple, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really quite simple.
Listen and apologise. Listen and apologise. Listen and apologise.
I love that, but you know what? I really think it's such a powerful rule. The yes, but
yes.
And I put in a though.
Because you put a though and not a but.
Instead of a yes, but I switched in a though, and I thought I'd got past the radar, but no. Yeah, and that's it. We've just got to just dive in there, get ready to be uncomfortable.
Yes.
With love. Leave your shame at the door. It will bubble up. We've got hot in the face when I suddenly realised what I'd done.
It's gone now. It's okay.
And it's gone, exactly. Yeah. And then the connection is there. And, you know.
Every moment we have with each other is a moment to build trust or lose trust. Which one do you want to do?
Mm. And you know what? It's my unwillingness to lose that trust with you that makes me catch it and go, I know what I did. Hold on. Because you were willing to perhaps go past it.
I would have let it slide. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And I was like, not going to let that. No. Build that trust back up. Nova, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
How can people get in touch with you? How can people work with you? How can they get you to work within their companies or deliver workshops in their companies or work with them individually?
So I have a number of ways. So I only work with progressive companies who are open and willing to change that outcome. I don't go into companies where I'm going to be in a boxing ring with people saying, but yes, but it's people like, we know this is a problem in society, or we're doing this well, but we don't want to rest on our laurels. And how can we be better allies in the workplace for our black and brown staff? And how can we be better? So I work with those kinds of companies, and that is anything from consultancy right through to doing ongoing workshops, anti-racism workshops and things like that.
Yep.
And then with individuals, I have an online course, which you graduated from.
Thank you very much.
Was my first graduate. And that is opening hearts and minds and changing lives, which is really incredible to see now. We're seeing people come through. I've also got a series of live evening events called Conversations with Nova Reed.
My God, I cannot
wait. Which are starting in spring.
Yes!
And they're evening events. They're a very accessible price point. And I also run an anti-racism in-person supper club that will be in September this year.
Great.
But my evening in conversation with Nova will start from March. And I've also got some... What I realised recently was that a lot of this work requires a lot of confidence. Calling, you know, for you to do the work and then to be able to call other people in to catch yourself. And so I'll be doing something around confidence and anxiety as well. So,
oh, wow. Ooh, great. Lots. Yeah. So if they go to your website.
Yes, novareed.com, NovareedID.com. But I'm most active on Instagram.
Yes.
Nova Reed Official. Find me there. Send me a DM. Email me. And I'll be there. Waiting for you to join the revolution.
Yes, and definitely go and watch the TEDx talk because it's amazing and it is a real rallying cry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.